Let's begin with the foundations. Welcome to another lecture. Today we examine the 1980 film 9 to 5, a workplace comedy that to some extent smuggles a serious labor argument inside farce and song. I am Alexei. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, I'm Priyanka. I'm glad we're talking about this one. It's sneakily sharp beneath the jokes.
To frame our discussion, 9 to 5 is an American workplace comedy directed by Colin Higgins and co-written with Patricia Resnick, released by 20th Century Fox in December 1980. It's important to understand that the film stages office life as a laboratory for examining sexism, pay inequity, and surveillance, yet it maintains buoyant comic momentum rather than didactic lecturing.
So, definitions. When we say office hierarchy, we mean the structured ranking of roles, from clerical staff to supervisors to executives. And gendered power dynamics refers to how gender shapes who holds authority, who is heard, and who is vulnerable to harassment or pay disparities. Can we also note job sharing as two people splitting one position, and in-office daycare as employer-provided childcare on-site?
Precisely. And if you will, vice president here denotes a senior corporate role below the president or chairman. In the film, that role belongs to Franklin Hart Jr., whose behavior exemplifies the misuse of hierarchical power against staff, particularly women. This brings us to the film's premise. Three secretaries, played by Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dolly Parton, fantasize about overturning their sexist boss, and then, through a sequence of mishaps and ingenuity, actually do so while implementing humane reforms.
Why is this still relevant? I think because many workplaces still negotiate versions of these same issues: pay equity, flexible schedules, childcare support, and harassment prevention. Before 9 to 5, popular media often trivialized or sidestepped those topics. The film put them at the center, but wrapped in humor that made broad audiences listen.
Indeed, the stakes are not merely comic. The narrative argues that equitable policies are compatible with and even conducive to productivity. In the story world, employee-friendly reforms increase output by about 20%. Theoretically, the film thus reframes fairness as not only ethically sound, but operationally rational, a point many organizations still debate. Moving on to our next point. The film opened in December 1980, directed by Colin Higgins, starring Jane Fonda as Judy Burnley, Lily Tomlin as Violet Newstead, Dolly Parton in her film debut as Dora Lee Rhodes, with Dabney Coleman as the infamous Franklin Hart Jr., Elizabeth Wilson as Roz, and Sterling Hayden as Chairman Russell Tinsworthy. It grossed about $103 million domestically, a major commercial success for a satirical workplace comedy.
And the music mattered. Parton wrote the title song on set, famously clicking her acrylic nails to mimic a typewriter rhythm. The single topped both the Billboard Hot 100 and the US country charts. It won two Grammys and brought the movie into radio spaces where film advertising couldn't reach so easily.
We observed that initial reviews were mixed to positive. Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars and called Parton a natural-born movie star, while others wished for more bite. Aggregate scores later settled around 70% at Rotten Tomatoes, with a mixed to average range on Metacritic. Yet its persistence is notable. By 2000, the American Film Institute ranked it number 74 on its 100 Funniest Movies list, and later placed the title song on its 100 Years, 100 Songs list.
The plot details are exuberant. A near poisoning due to a rat poison and sweetener mix-up, a misidentified corpse, then kidnapping and blackmail. The boss ends up hogtied and suspended in a hang gliding harness, tethered to a garage door opener. Somehow it stays light, and the office reforms actually work in his absence.
Speaking of that lightness, there are delightful production quirks. The story is set in Los Angeles, yet the opening montage includes San Francisco iconography, such as a Muni electric bus with a K-Fog advertisement and the ferry building clock. One can even glimpse the Brown twins. For a later DVD commentary, Hart's Bel Air house at 10431 Bellagio Road belonged to the Chandler family at the time. Visual shorthand for executive insulation from rank-and-file realities.
Then it kept echoing. There was a TV sitcom adaptation across the 1980s, including first-run syndication, with 85 episodes in total. Dolly Parton's sister, Rachel Dennison, played Doralee. A Broadway musical opened in 2009 with Allison Janney, Stephanie J. Block, and Megan Hilty, followed by a national tour in 2010. More recently, there's the 2022 documentary Still Working 9-to-5. The film is also on Disney Plus after the 2019 acquisition of Fox assets.
It is worth noting the film's afterlife keeps evolving. A sequel was explored and later dropped in 2019, while a reimagining has been reported in development at 20th Century Studios with Jennifer Aniston and Kristen Hahn producing. And subsequent casting discussions surfaced publicly. The cultural conversation has not closed. It has simply migrated across formats and generations. Before we get to the complexities, a brief personal note. My interest here is how popular media often functions as a barometer. 9-to-5 takes grievances clerical workers voiced in the late 1970s and translates them into a grammar of jokes, songs, and sight gags. The resulting laughter is not evasive, it is evidentiary. This logically leads us to three guiding questions. Priyanka, would you introduce them for us?
Sure. First, historically, what real-world conditions shaped the film's picture of office sexism? Second, counterfactually, what if the movie had been made as a drama rather than a comedy? Third, today, which of the depicted workplace reforms remain contested, and what remains to be learned?
Let's start with the history. In 1980, clerical labor in the United States was heavily feminized. Many workers described themselves in Jane Fonda's research as de facto office wives expected to perform personal tasks for male superiors. We observe that the film emerged from Fonda's engagement with a real organization of office workers called 9-to-5. Those testimonies supplied both texture and grievance to the screenplay.
Professor Alexei, may I ask, what were the real-world influences that shaped the film's portrayal of office sexism? Concretely, which elements came from the research?
To elaborate, Fonda and collaborators listened to accounts of wage suppression, idea theft, and sexual harassment that went unpunished. Employees narrated being asked to fetch coffee, buy gifts, manage personal calendars, or absorb blame for managerial errors. The script converts these recurring patterns into character arcs. Violet as the overlooked senior problem solver, Judy as the novice rebuilding autonomy post-divorce, Doralee is the target of rumor and unwanted advances from Hart. The ensemble is not a composite by accident. It is a map of systemic patterns.
Professor, could you clarify how these real accounts were integrated into the screenplay? Was it mostly dialogue, or more like situational design?
Both. Higgins and Resnick designed situations that literalize complaints the association documented. Hart steals ideas, deploys surveillance through Roz, and weaponizes rumor against Doralee. In Hart's absence, the women implement equal pay trajectories, flexible hours, job sharing, and daycare, reforms that the narrative then correlates with a 20% productivity uptick. In simpler terms, the film stages a controlled experiment. Remove the abusive variable, introduce humane parameters, and observe performance gains.
And it keeps the tone playful with the accidental rat poison mix-up, the hog tie, and the garage door harness. That choice feels deliberate, like emotional insulation, letting audiences look directly at ugly behavior without flinching away.
Moving forward to the counterfactual, what if 9 to 5 had been a drama, as early concepts entertained? Arguably, a sober treatment might have pleased some critics who sought a darker bite. However, the mainstream reach likely would have contracted. Parton's presence as both charismatic performer and songwriter, plus the title track's ubiquity, created a cross-media echo chamber that a drama might not have activated.
Professor, what if 9 to 5 had been made as a straight drama? Would it have been as impactful? Or would it have been, maybe, admired, but less seen?
We can infer that impact scales with exposure, the film's box office, the song topping charts, home video and cable rotation, and eventually streaming all increased its reach. Those pipelines were strengthened by comedy's replay value and by Parton's cross-genre stardom. A drama might have secured critical essays, a comedy secured households. And to be clear, comedy did not negate critique. It laundered it into familiarity.
Professor Alexei, how did the comedic elements enhance the film's message specifically? Is it the fantasies, the slapstick, the song, or the way the chairman credits Hart for reforms the women made, which kind of underlines the absurdity?
All of the above. The fantasy sequences externalize private rage safely. Slapstick, near poisoning, hogtie, garage door harness, creates cognitive distance so audiences can process systemic misconduct without despair. The title song, with its typewriter click rhythm, functions as mnemonic propaganda for the film's thesis. And the chairman's misattribution of credit satirizes how hierarchies mask labor. Mathematically speaking, the sum of these devices is greater than the parts. They create retention, repeat viewing, and discussion. Even President Reagan's diary objection to the marijuana gag reveals the film's cultural penetration into unlikely living rooms. Let's shift focus to the present-day question. Are the reforms still progressive? Some, like equal pay and robust parental support, remain aspirational in practice. Others, like flexible hours and job sharing, are discussed widely but implemented unevenly. The film's fictional 20% productivity bump supplies a narrative proof of concept. Real workplaces continue to evaluate comparable outcomes with mixed constraints and incentives.
Professor, are the reforms shown in the film still considered progressive today, or are they baseline expectations that many places still fail to meet?
It's crucial to understand that baselines and best practices are not identical. Equal pay remains a headline metric. Flexible scheduling and childcare support continue to be negotiated within cost structures. Surveillance has evolved technologically, but raises old questions about trust. The film's argument holds. Respect and autonomy correlate with performance. The implementation parameters, however, are context-dependent.
Professor, what areas still need more research or improvement? I guess I'm thinking about pay gaps, harassment reporting, and how policy meets culture on the ground.
To summarize the frontier briefly, first, pay equity metrics that incorporate role, tenure, and promotion velocity. Second, harassment reporting that reduces retaliation risk while maintaining procedural fairness. Third, the efficacy of family-friendly policies as retention levers across career stages. And fourth, cultural change that decouples authority from impunity. The film dramatizes these as narrative binaries, Hart versus everyone else. But organizational research reminds us that culture shifts by accumulation, not epiphany.
It makes me wonder how much of 9 to 5's endurance is because audiences still recognize the pattern, even if the dress code has changed. Also, small trivia that I love, the opening credits confuse the geography a bit with San Francisco images for a story set in Los Angeles. It's a perfect metaphor for how workplaces can look similar on the surface while operating very differently inside.
In conclusion, 9to5 addresses workplace sexism through comedy, converting grievances gathered from real office workers into a mainstream narrative that still travels well across formats and decades. We considered three questions: the historical inputs drawn from the 9to5 association, the counterfactual of a dramatic version, and why comedy amplified reach, and the current status of reforms that remain partially implemented and persistently debated. For further comparative study, one might examine Horrible Bosses, which modernizes the revenge against management template in a different key. This then completes our present analysis. Thank you for listening. Continue reading, watching, and as always, comparing narratives to the structures they portray.
Thank you, Professor. That was helpful to think through, actually. And thanks to everyone for being with us today.